la prima parte dell'ultimo film di uno degli autori che preferiamo qui all'Acquasto, Mr. Steve Zissou. Subito dopo il film ci sarà un breve dibattito con il regista. Grazie.
Where are they? What is the setting?
Italy.
Okay, maybe it's Italy. It's, what do you think you're seeing? A theater, right? You think this is a space of art. Is that fair to say? You think you might be seeing opera, ballet, some kind of classical something, some art of some sort, maybe even a magician. But you're here to see art. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
All right. You know what? I'm actually going to rewind for 1 second, because I want to show you one other thing. Yeah? When it's playing, smartass. Fuck it. All right, forget that. I'm going to show you something else, but I'll ignore that. All right. All right. What's interesting? Oh, fucking A, I hate technology. I hate this technology. That's not pause. All right. What's conspicuous? Anybody, what's conspicuous here?
The curtain.
Okay, curtain, why? Why is the curtain of note? Okay, good, good, good. Right. You're getting two frames here. Right? You get the frame of the curtain, you get the frame of the frame, of the screen. Right? So you get a doubling of the frame. Right? And what I actually wanted to rewind and show you is the movie opens, the curtain opens. It's the first thing. It's how all his early movies open, Wes Anderson. Everything's a stage. He lets you know it's all a stage. Right? The film director, the film will never be a secret, this magic thing that happens elsewhere. It is always already of the screen. Right? It is, there's no outside the fray, right? He folds the fabric of, literally the fabric of the frame into the picture itself. So that's good. What else? What about the coral?
It's like, it's as if on the other side, us, the audience, is peeking through the sea life coral, which is like natural to the sea, and so it's like people that it's popping out.
Okay. And why does that matter?
I haven't decided yet.
Okay, good, good, good. Fair enough. It's an excellent answer. Excellent answer. What else is obvious? Yeah. What's that? It's a third frame. What's a third frame? Okay. Multiplication of frames. I'll take that. That's good. Remy. It's obviously fake. This movie does an excellent job of is breaking down any line between fake and real, right? So you go on to see that all the animals in it are animated, right? They're CGI. They're not real, but there will never have been a real, right? This movie erases the distinction between the real and the artificial, the real and the representation. What else?
Looks like
what's that? What about the opening titles?
It's just showing like the self-consciousness, the self-awareness of like
the Yeah. How? Be more. I think you're saying it, but be more explicit. How? Because you're seeing a film.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, we're seeing a film within a film. And what is this title? What title does this name? Which film?
Both films,
right? And this film does an unbelievable job of folding itself onto itself, right? The film you're watching is the film you're watching being made as you're watching it. Right? What else? What's our venue and what's happening here?
The Obiami Way Peninsula, a remote and fascinating region teeming with extraordinary marine life. We chose its mysterious waters as the Belafonte's next destination. In preparation for our voyage, the members of Team Zissou gathered at my oceanographic observatory here on Peshispata Island. This was to be our most ambitious adventure to date.
And our most ambitious what? Oh, I like the adventure. We'll talk about adventures in a minute. Remember our setting here. Right? Our setting was in an art venue, right? It was in a performance venue, a place of performance. And what are we getting?
Adventure.
Yeah, but what is this reference? What mode of cultural artifact is the film we're watching? Yeah, right. It's presumably a documentary, right? About that documents aquatic life. So you're in a performance space to see art, and you're getting something that presumably is of a completely different genre, right? A completely different knowledge of domain, open to different criteria. Okay? Do you assess an opera the same way you assess a documentary on, you know, sharks? Do you make sense of them the same way? Do they serve the same function culturally? Think about how they're distributed. Right? This film clearly looks not. The film within the film looks like something you might see in your classroom, right? In like fourth grade, to learn about sharks because the teacher is too freaking stupid to actually teach you. So they show you a film that somebody else is too stupid to do anything made, right? And so you sit and watch something. But what's happening here? This is, you get this unabashed collapse of the line that would separate knowledge from art. This is a Nietzschean. This is a post-Nietzschean film, right? This is Nietzsche's argument in Truth and Lies, that art comes first, right? And Steve Zissou never separates the two. That is his character. He'll never separate document from performance. Throughout the film, they're constantly discovering things, finding things, and then cutting it in the studio. His boat becomes a floating studio, a production house. Think about the difference between a film production house and a laboratory. You think they'd be two separate things, right? One is a place of manipulation, one a place of discovery. But this film collapses the two. Manipulation and discovery become conflated. This film operates always already beyond the distinction between truth and falsehood, between what's real and what's fake. The film, this is an extra-moral film. This is Truth and Lies in an extra-moral sense. Does that make sense?
Yep.
All right, let's...
Ultimately a tragic one. Our team included. Esteban Duplantier, chief diver. Our senior statesman, my closest colleague for 27 years. Klaus Daimler, 40, engineer. Calm, collected, German. Vikram Ray, 28, cameraman. Born on the Ganges. Bobby Ogata, 22, frogman. Renzo Pietro, 45, editor, soundman. Vladimir Wolodarsky, 33, physicist, original score composer.
Right, again, look at the seamless conflation, right? Physicist, score composer, right? It's a continuous list that realigns the categories of knowledge and art and puts them under the same rubric. Seamlessly, shamelessly, without thinking about it. When Nietzsche talks about the free intellect, who takes the scaffolding of culture, of knowledge, and then puts it back together, disassembles them, puts it back together playfully in an ironic fashion. That's what they do here. There's no, it doesn't even feel revolutionary. It's so post-revolutionary. It's already there. It's already operating in that place that I want you guys at the end of this class to already be operating in. Get rid of the distinction between the real and the artificial, right? The real and the imitation, between knowledge and art. When you can completely make that move and see that claims to knowledge are just arguments within the artistic world and all art is just arguments about the world, you will be there. You will be where this film always already is operating. Right? And that one seamless slip right there, that seamless list, right? Physicist, score composer, doesn't distinguish. These are his titles, all of the same thing.
Anne-Marie Sackowitz, 25, script girl. Pele Dos Santos, 30, safety expert. Eleanor Zissou, my wife, vice president of the Zissou Society. We had also invited 7 marine science students from the University of North Alaska to accompany us as unpaid interns in exchange for school credit. October 12th, Esteban and I explore the blue reefs beyond the peninsula. Fluorescent snapper unexpectedly appear in the shallows. Extremely rare at this.
Come on, look at that. Look at that. Right? The thing that they're capturing, the document that they're capturing that's real, the fish, to us is already fake. Right? It's not fake to him. It's not that they're making it up. In the body of this film, the thing that he's discovering and documenting is explicitly to us in the audience something that's fake. Right? Which, in the body of the film then, in the flow of the film, eliminates the distinction between the fake and the real. Does that make sense? You with me on that at all? Right? The thing that's being documented, the thing that's supposedly the basis of fact in here, is an animation. Right? So any grounds, it's not like there's a secret truth lurking behind here. Right? Well, they're all playing around, but then they're really capturing fish, no? The fish are playing too. The fish are always already playing. The fish have taken leave of the real, and now they're frolicking in animated land. A great shot, right? It just throws back again, what are you watching? And what is the relationship between this kind of play? This kind of play, this play that is extra moral and an audience, right? That a clip of watching invites the it's an image of the rhetorical exchange. Right? Why else show that clip? What is that moment where we're watching, the audience watching the thing we're watching? You understand what I just said? Right? It's a strange moment, right? Because it means the place of audience now is strange, right? We're in a different audience, but we're also audience, right? At this point, the audience and us are the one and the same. But then we're given a view of viewing. We're given a view of the rhetorical event, right? And that rhetorical event gets complexified at that juncture, because we'll see afterwards in the Q&A and how they try to interpret them, right? When you operate extra morally, the way people interpret you might be complicated, because they might interpret you morally. Right? It's a problem I have all the time in my life. All the time. Right? You want to make a judgment. You want to say something, and you're not being judgmental. You're just saying something. People judge it morally. They think you're making a claim. Right? When you're not, you're just saying. Right? Obama. It's a cool name. Obama. It freaks people out. What do you mean it's a cool name? Are you for him or against him? I don't know. It's a funny name. I like it. Right? It just sounds like a good name to have in the White House to say all the time. You get tired of hearing the same names over and over again. All these Goyish names. Obama. Sounds good. People get, well, you're being dismissive. No. I'm really just saying I like the name. Right? But this film operates, shows you glimpses of the life you will be faced with if you choose the non-moral path. Yeah, right.
There's your gun. Steve! That's Esteban!
Is that thing rolling?
Vikram!
Encounter with Holly, abnormal! Shark-like fish! 10 meters in length! Unfamiliar dorsal features! Spots all over it! I shot it dorsally with a homing dart! Esteban was eaten! Jump the scanning guard! Start tracking before it dies too deep!
Esteban was bitten?
Eaten!
Is he dead?
Esteban was eaten!
He was swallowed whole?
No! Chewed! Check the scanning monitor!
He's got hydrogen psychosis. Crazy eye.
Steve, they think you got crazy eye.
Get him out of the fucking water.
Esteban! 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 Esteban!
Steve!
Esteban!
Esteban! Esteban! Esteban!
Watch this and we'll stop.
È stata una scelta deliberata quella di non far vedere mai lo squalo giaguaro.
Was it a deliberate choice never to show the jaguar shark?
No, I dropped the camera.
No, ho perso la macchina da presa, mi è caduta.
Why are they laughing?
Why is that interesting? What's going on here, right? Yeah, Remy. Yeah, but what rhetorically is happening here in the exchange? Like, why? There seems to be a disconnect between his world and the world around him, right? I mean, they ask him, was it deliberate? Was it a deliberate choice? Are you making art? He's like, right? He's been called on him for being an artist, and he's like, no. I dropped the camera. Right? There will be this constant confusion of documentary, of just fact and art throughout the film, right? He's like, that's what happened, right? And then they're laughing as if that's an art in and of itself, and he's like, no, that's the fact. Right?
Lassù. Lì in fondo.
Yes. What's next for Team Zsu?
Well, that was only part one. It's a cliffhanger.
It's what?
Now I'm going to go...
It's what? It's a cliffhanger. He's operating in the realm of story. Document and story have become one and the same thing. Right? It's a cliffhanger. Right? And he's going to satisfy the conditions of story. Right? Isn't this presumably a documentary? Where is this operating? What place can this be taking place in? Certainly no place that we know of casually. We're just inventing a world here.
On that shark, or whatever it is, and hopefully kill it. I don't know how yet. Maybe dynamite.
You don't know what it is?
No, I've never seen anything like it before in my life.
You say it is a jaguar shark. That's the title of your film.
It was coming right at us. I just said the first two words that came into my head.
Right? It's an amazing moment, right? First of all, why is he going to blow it up? Yeah, and what is revenge? Yeah, it's a storyline, right? A documentarian, a founder of facts, doesn't go and blow stuff up. On the other hand, he's being absolutely real. He wants to go blow this thing up because it ate his friend. So his satisfaction of a story is the documenting of his life, is real, right? There's an inversion of the relationship between the real and the imitation here. He's actually proffering the real, but real and art for him are indistinguishable. Right? And what happens when you collapse these things? What happens when the real and the imitation or the dream become one and the same thing? It becomes an adventure. That's why he's an adventurer. That's what Nietzsche says, right? Once truth is exiled, once truth is rendered moot, and we live in a realm of where anything is possible, like for the honest Athenian, where Athena herself might walk down the street, anything is possible. It literally is an adventure. A venture that is forward-looking, that's what it means, that's what adventure means. It's a forward-looking formation of propriety, a forward-looking making of the world. You don't know what's going to come. That's what an adventure is. You don't know what's going to happen. It's an unknown. And so an adventure is an unknown movement into in through the world, which is such an interesting perspective for someone who's claiming to be a scientist of a sort, right? They're documentarians documenting the natural world, but they're adventurers. Imagine being a scientist who's an adventurer rather than a confirmer of the known. Nietzsche says over and over again that what the scientist does is confirm the known. It's a graveyard of perceptions, the laboratory. And that's what scientific production is. It's dead perceptions. Adventures are the opposite. Adventures are you don't know what's going to happen. It's the live perception, the live event. So this is an image of knowing that is adventurous. When you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to happen. Right? You can picture being the kid in the lab. I mean, this is a recurring image in our of youth, right? In science, in high school, right? The kids come in, they start throwing a bunch of shit together, stuff, something blows up. That's adventuresome knowing. They learned something. They didn't confirm something. They didn't satisfy the equation that the teacher asked them to satisfy. But they learned something. They did something. Right? This is adventurous knowing.
C'est une espèce en voie de disparition. Pourquoi vouloir la tuer?
That's an endangered species at most. What would be the scientific purpose of killing it?
Revenge.
Perfect, right? Perfect. There, you see what's the scientific purpose? Revenge, right? You don't even know how to answer the question, right? They're operating in two different worlds. All right. You guys just want to watch more movies.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. But you know what? Nothing is more tiring than watching a movie. I'm going to show you more pictures. But nothing is more tiring than watching a movie, right? The way you guys watch movies, you don't actually watch movies. I hate to tell you, right? You sit down, you lie on the couch, you know, you probably eat your stupid popcorn, which would be illegal in movie theaters. And you're like, But to read a movie is no different than reading Nietzsche, right? You got to be active. It's exhausting. Right, I can probably watch maybe 5 films a year. Right, I'll watch some crap late night on TV on HBO. I'll watch some rerun of some terrible thing. Right, but that's not watching a film. That's just Valium because I'm, you know, the doctor won't prescribe it for me all the time. Right, so there's no difference between ESPN, American Idol, and most of the shit that comes out of Hollywood. It's just it's something just it's death. It's a little death for a while, which is not always a bad thing. You watch a film, it's exhausting. Exhausting, right? It's 2 hours. It's so dense. When you're reading a book, you're reading a Nietzsche, you can stop, you can look around, you can pause, you can walk away, come back to it. You're watching a film, it's just like a two-hour assault on you. It's incredibly pithy, right? And it's the image is so multifarious. Things are happening on so many levels simultaneously, right? It's not just this piece of candy for you. You're being worked out conceptually, affectively, in so many ways. The film is constantly making cuts. How does it move from point A to point B? Film is such a complicated ethic, such a complicated algorithm. So you either want to kick back and watch movies. That's not reading. That's just, you know, a little death, which is not a bad thing.
Isn't that the difference between the two?
Huh? Which two?
Like playing baseball and playing the baseball game. You can go out and throw the ball around and hit a ball real fast, but playing the game is actually, you know, being in depth, being, like you said, watching the film, you're engrossed in it, you have to participate in every aspect.
Yeah. I mean, of course, there are some players who are less engrossed, but yeah. I don't think it's as easy a distinction as playing and watching, because you can be very engrossed watcher, is what I'm saying. Right? I mean, there's a mode of watching the film just as a mode of reading a book that occupies you, that colonizes you, that animates you, right? And that you, it become incredibly difficult, right? And I think most films that come out of Hollywood, their job is to kind of just sort of glide. They want to confirm the known. That girl's familiar, that guy's familiar, their interactions are familiar. What happens when the relationships are not familiar? Right? What I was showing this Zissou was to help explain the Nietzsche a little bit and help move you to this place where you really begin to understand knowledge as an aesthetic production, right? And vice versa. You begin to understand aesthetic production as knowledge. Right? It's different than information, but it becomes a way of knowing, right? So we're going to look at some images here, and we're going to talk about what kind of knowing they give us. What world do they give us? Yeah. Because it's already erased in Nietzsche's sense of truth and lies in a non-moral sense. That it's erased any distinction. If morality is the thing that knows, he never knows, he's always adventuring. Right? It's always a not knowing. It's a not knowing. The conditions of knowing for him are a not knowing. Right? There's a scene in the film where someone says something, he's either running onto the boat and he's like, no one knows what's going to happen, and you film it. That's the point. You don't know what's going to happen. Right? What a beautiful, bizarre approach to knowledge. Right? That's the Nietzschean approach. You don't know. You come to the world not knowing rather than knowing. Right? Think about how fundamentally different mindsets those are. Right? Do you already know what it is before you get there? Or you go and you don't know what's going to happen? You hope for something weird. The whole premise of this film is that he seems to be on a downslide. People aren't interested in his adventures. Nothing that adventuresome has happened to him. And finally something adventuresome happens to him, and he re-achieves his fame. Right? But that's, you don't know what's going to happen. You get out there, maybe it's boring. Right? How do you foment interesting events? What a weird way to go. Right? Imagine that. Imagine rather than going to your lab and trying to confirm what everybody knows, you purposefully seek unspeakable events. That's your goal. Every time you enter the lab, you want to make something new, impossibly unique, and exciting. Every time. And maybe beautiful. This is what Nietzsche's trying to give us. Two fundamentally different postures towards life. Towards what you want from life. How do you approach life? Do you lean into it, or are you a little bit afraid of it? For Nietzsche, the scientist, the philosopher, the moralist, the religious are afraid. They're afraid of life. They don't like life. They don't like themselves. They want life to go away. They want to die. And that's what knowledge is. Let's all die. Right? On the other hand is the free intellect who plays on things, who comes to life and makes it, who co-makes it, who makes it with life. And that's what we get with Steve Zissou. Right? He's a Nietzschean scientist who's operating always already beyond the distinction between truthhood and falsehood. Right? He doesn't think he's doctoring his films. That's what he's constantly accused of throughout the movie. Did you just doctor that shot? He doesn't understand the difference between doctoring a shot and capturing a shot. It's the same thing. Right? Because it's all already art to begin with. So Steve Zissou is a good way to make sense of Nietzsche. That was my thought. All right, you want to look at some pictures? Some art? All right, look at some art. All right. So I grabbed shit I had lying around from other classes. So, I don't know, Ian and Karina, if you're here, you've seen all these things before. All right. That's not going to work. All right, let's look at this one. First, when approaching an image, right, there is, of course, just like with a text, a written text, there's a rhetorical exchange, there's a rhetorical milieu, there's a rhetorical positioning. Just as you're choreographed by the text you're reading, you look at an image, you are put in a certain position, right? What position are you? Just think about where you're standing as you look at this. Where are you? How are you oriented? All right. I think we generally think about pictures. If you're looking at a painting, it's on the wall. You're looking at it directly, right? It faces you, you face it. But of course, that's not quite right. That's true of the object called the painting. But what about this face? How do you stand towards this face? And this face is on the wall. Where is this person? How can you be looking at this angle? Where are you in relationship to this person? This is a kind of confrontation. Where are you? How can you be seeing this? Yeah. Where really? I mean, it's really bizarre, right? You're kind of standing above her. You're kind of impossibly close, but you couldn't be that close while standing above her. Right? You're literally situated. Any image you look at, you're being situated by it, just as a written text situates you. Right? Puts you in a relationship to it. It's sort of like a duel. Right? It throws down the gauntlet. It says, hey, it throws down its gauge. Here, you want to engage me? This is how you're going to engage me. This is where I'm standing. What's your next move? Right? So this picture, again, quite literally takes you off your feet. Right? But at the same time, of course, it doesn't take you off your feet because there's two objects at least here, at least two objects. There's actually more. We'll start with two objects, one of which is the painting. Thing you can carry around on a canvas, right? That's an object you can look at. You can turn it upside down. You can look at it backwards. You can do all kinds of things with it, right? But then, of course, there's her. There's his face, right? So there's at least two objects here. The painting you're looking at straight on, probably, right? It's hanging in the museum. It's here on the wall. You're looking right at it. But at the same time, the thing you're looking at within the picture displaces you. You can't be standing where you're standing. So the mere looking at this picture has immediately put you in two places simultaneously, which is already weird. You've been multiplied as viewer. You're both standing there and not standing there. You're standing there and you're hovering several feet above yourself at the same time. Right? That's its rhetorical sort of event it begins to forge. What else? Anything? I'm going to look at a couple more. I want to just spend a minute looking at that face. What do we learn here? What argument does this image make about, let's say, humanity? This makes an argument, just as everything is an argument. And for those people out there, you know what, I'll post these on the blog. We're looking at a bunch of Luchenfreud paintings. What argument does this make? Do you like to look at it? Yeah, me either. I kind of hate Luchenfreud. I think he's brilliant. I never want to look at them. But I think they're amazing, and a lot of things I think are amazing I never want to look at. To me, one thing that's kind of conspicuous is the seamless palette, right, of this bleeding of the walls, the leaves into the faces, right? But there seems to be a kind of argument that humanity here seems to be kind of a local concretion of possibilities of going, right, that there's not such a rigid distinction here between the human and the not human, and the leaves and the floor. Right? There's not such a stark contrast. Yeah.
The scale seems
strange. Mm. If you look at the people, the woman on the floor seems smaller.
Good. Very nice.
And the man's hands seem kind of large compared to...
Really good, yes. That's excellent, right? And we think about perspective in paintings all the time. But let's think about that word perspective, because we talk about it here. Perspective is an argument. It's a take. It's a take on something, right? So what's interesting about images is you're literally seeing a perspective. You're not just seeing the image. You're seeing the perspective, right? That's what, every picture is always already an argument. Just as a word is always already an argument, right? Every time you take up a word, you're already taking up someone else's argument, right, about the world, right? You inherit language, and then you have to kind of make do with this inheritance, right? When you look at an image, you're not just seeing an image, you're seeing a seeing. You're literally seeing this perspective. Like, what perspective is this? Right? Freud saw something, was standing somewhere, somehow saw the world in some way. Hands are bigger, this is extended, and that's what we're seeing. Not just people, but the seeing of people. We're seeing an argument about how to see the world. Right? I can't even imagine something more explicitly empirical and scientific. Here's Ludwig Freud saying, this is the world. Here's the world. I can't imagine anything. I mean, art to me is the most explicitly scientific thing. It makes the most explicit claims to knowledge. It says, here, this is the world. What's more empirical than this? Here's the world as I see it. Here it is. Not through the abstractions of concept. This is a radical empiricism. This is the world as it appears. What's more scientific than this? Love it. You have no idea what I'm talking about. Right. And there's the man himself, Peyton himself. And look at the flesh. So you've just seen three or four Lucian Freuds. What argument could you make, does Freud make about flesh? Look at that. What is the speed of flesh? What is the, how does flesh go for him? How does it go? Think about yourself. Think about arguments. Does your skin stick to your body? Is it falling off your body? Do your bones support it? Does your skin support your bones? Priscilla.
It's kind of like a story of, like, you know, the wrinkles of where you suffered and where you laughed.
Right. That's nice. So that's good. Good. So the body for Freud then would be a kind of screen, a canvas of experience. So you get a doubling of the canvas, right? If for Freud, in some way, to extend Priscilla's argument, right, the face itself is a kind of screen or a kind of canvas where the world draws its masterpiece. It literally writes on you. Right? That's what wrinkles are. Vincent's freaking out. He's got some gray hairs, right? The world writes itself on you, and sometimes you're surprised by it. You're like, how did I get that? Where'd that come from? Right? Because your body kind of eludes you. You're not totally in control. The world writes you. You're just canvas. Remy.
I don't know if you can hear, but his body is completely squashed up while the background is smooth.
Okay, good, good, good. Say more.
Well, I don't know. Maybe what's happening behind you is what's the chaos.
I kind of like the chaos of the skin. It's a nice figure. I'm not sure it's quite right, but I like it as a figure. Right? It's definitely a kind of flux of the skin.
Perhaps it suggests the receptivity of the skin. Its propensity to be pressed upon, to retain.
That's nice.
Those experiences.
That's nice, right? Skin is something that's sort of extending Priscilla's argument, right? It is something, it has a kind of pliability. And at the same time, it's a little like silly putty, right? It takes the world, literally takes the world. Right. Yeah, I like that. What if we, this is all good. What if the skin here, I mean, there's an aspect to the skin that doesn't seem totally passive to me. Right? I like that as an argument. But to inflect it a little bit and make it a little more complicated, the flesh for him seems almost actively to be kind of oozing or undulating. Right? It almost has its own sort of will to go, its own kind of viscosity. Right? I don't think I have any Francis Bacons in here. But Francis Bacon, it's constantly showing the flesh falling off the bones. Right? Of a face, and literally your skin is just hanging off. It's barely a face, it's this mauled flesh hanging off. Right? And it's interesting to look at Bacon next to Freud, two completely grotesque painters to me, that the 20th century is nuts about. It's a little striking, right? We're afraid of our bodies, really. But for Freud, I think there's a little more coherence, but it's thick. I mean, it feels almost rubbery but viscous, right? It's oily, but it has a weight to it. And it's very different than, like, you know, the pristine sort of, you know, Raphaelite. You know, everything sort of pure and alabaster. Think about those portraits from whatever freaking century anyone here knows history of art would know better than I do. Right? Where the girl's face is all white and plump and perfect, and now look at this. Two very different readings of art, two very different readings of a face, of skin, of what skin is. Of what skin is. This is a scientific argument. If I were a doctor, I would look at Luch and Freud's. Right? If I were skinned out, I was a dermatologist, this is something I would study. I'm not kidding. Right? To learn about the flesh. That's interesting. Where was I just, maybe it was like last semester I was teaching this, someone was like, I can't look at that, I think he's going to come out there and kick my ass, man. It's not that he doesn't want to make eye contact with me because he's just afraid. It's that he doesn't give a shit. Right? It's not the engagement with the human. I mean, I think it's almost, he gives us a little the inhumanity of the human. Right? If you could couple this with the painting beforehand of the four sort of freaks on that chair. And I try to argue that with that palette, the people are kind of like leaves, kind of like the floor. There's a kind of inhumanity within the human, which is what Nietzsche is arguing too, right? That there's nothing special about the human. We partake of the bestial just like all beasts do, right? We're of the bestial realm. We're of this world. We're the material of this world. We're not separate from the world. We're of the world. We're made up of the same stuff of the world. Very nice. Very, very nice, right? It sort of eludes the kind of humanity as depth or as an identity, but just as this flesh kind of. Yeah, that's nice. That's smart. Yes, yeah, nice. Huh. Yeah, it's funny to think of it as both thick and transparent at the same time. And that's kind of what an Imbeciliputty is, right? It's a weird definition of the transparent. Does that make sense? Transparent, rather than something you see through, it's something that just wears the world, everything that happens to it, right on it. It's a very different notion of transparent. I don't even know if that's transparent anymore, right? I mean, transparent is presumably what you look through versus the thing that sits there and wears its world on itself. If somebody who shows all their emotions on their face, are they transparent? Or is it the opposite kind of transparent? They're projectors. They project everything. There's nothing to look through. Different spatial arguments. Yes, sir.
To me, it doesn't really look like the thing at all. It looks instead to me like he's almost been turned inside out. And you're seeing
it. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. It does. He looks like he's kind of been gutted or splayed or something. But I kind of like that. It's almost like the flesh is. Yeah, the line between surface and depth is erased, kind of. Right? That's kind of over...
Yeah,
I agree. It's like he's bleeding his own skin or something. It's like oozing out of him. Yeah, I find it just utterly repulsive. But it's something. That's all I want from the world. Surprise me. Surprise me. It's why I love them and I never want to look at them. Because it's every time I look at it, I'm wrestled. It's not just that it's grotesque. It's that it's because there are plenty of things that are grotesque I want to turn away from, right? Like Telegraph Ave. But this is a different kind of grotesque because it's surprising. It's like it's making an argument to me that's aggressive in a sense. Yeah.
Just like the swells
It's good. It's sort of that bestial quality, right? Just not, and sort of shapeless. Stuff's just going to grow places, right? As opposed to just the head. Is that kind of what you're suggesting? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like his skin has no, like, there's no, like, softness to it. Like, it's sort of patchy, kind of like
Right. Yeah, should we look at some more? What's happening? What's going on here? Besides a naked guy with his penis hanging out. Does this make everyone too uncomfortable? Should I change it? Can you handle a penis? Never say that. What's explicitly going on here that's already kind of bizarre? What's the most obvious strange thing here? Yeah. Circumstance?
Yeah.
What circumstance? Huh? Okay, good. Right? So the painting won't be narrative. It's not, right? Any paintings that are narrative, you generally don't want to look at. It means it's cause and effect. It's already explained itself. This doesn't explain itself. It actually gives you enigma. You don't know, which is the sign of something to reckon. If you already know what's going on, you already know it, then it's nothing. It's not happening. It's dead. It's literally a non-event. Just don't turn away. Nothing worse than a non-event. Just turn away from it. But this, you're like, eh. And in fact, I don't have to explain it. I never ask for a narrative explanation, right? So that's good. It's almost like two things forced up against each other, and yet there does seem to be some kind of relationship. But the relationship is complicated. Again, what's the really obvious thing? Okay. So what? Yeah, say more of that. What? Okay. Yeah. The line, right? I mean, the whole thing sort of leads right up to here. It's sort of, and there's a whole very complicated play of gazes of how everyone's looking at everybody else. Yeah.
Why does he continue to pose when she doesn't have a frame to paint anymore?
Good. All right. This is nice, right? The model has become the painting. Talk about the swapping of the artificial and the real. The model now is the painting, right? Is he the model for her? What's he modeling for? Right? Is he the model for her? Is he, you know, you picture the model's the thing that's supposed to disappear, and then you get, is the real thing, but then that disappears, and then I get the copy, the imitation, the thing I drew. Does that make sense? The relationship between model and painting, right? You're over there, you're my vase of flowers, but I'm drawing you. Now you go away. But now I painted a painting where you're the center of the thing, right? Like, if he's her model, I'm not being articulate here. Whose model is he? Right? You're getting a painting of the model. You're getting a painting of the painting. Right? I mean, presumably she's holding a paintbrush. She's covered in paint, it seems like. Right?
Another way of putting it would be, you're getting a painting of the production of the painting.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Good. Yes. Vincent put that better, right? So we're witnessing the production of the painting, but then where are we? Who are we? How can we be here? The painting's done. We're looking at the painting. But the painting's happening. But we're looking at the painting. But the painting's happening. But we're looking at the painting. Where are we? What position are we in? Yeah, Elena.
I think when we're thinking about what position that we're in, based on circumstances and like the objects within this painting, it makes you feel like you're the artist, right? That you're painting and there's like another painter that's there, perhaps? Or you know what I mean?
Sure. Good. Yeah. And the model's so confrontational here. The model's anything but passive. Look at the look on his face. He's staring right at you. He's not a passive model. Right? He's not just staring at you. He's letting it all hang out, man. I mean, his two major things, his eyes and his penis, are really explicit, right? They're just like, there's no shame, there's no hiding. There's a confrontation. It's almost as if the model, the thing that should just disappear, has stood up and become, has entered the image. It's just like, you know what, here I am. You can't just paint me, I'm here. But then he is painted. right? So you get this like doubling over of a model who becomes real, who becomes the model again. Does that make sense? He's sitting there as her model, but then he stepped forward and said, no, I'm not your model, I'm the thing, I'm the real thing. But then he gets painted again by Freud, and so he becomes, you have no idea what I'm talking about. He becomes a model again, right? So this kind of flip-flopping, from model to real to model. Does that make sense? In the painting itself, he's not a model. He's both a model and not a model. Right? But then the thing we're watching, of course, he's the model for the model. He's modeling. That's what he's doing, right? So I want you to model, not as a human being, but I want you to model being a model. I'm Freud. I want to paint this picture. Yo, dude, lay down naked on the couch. Pretend you're a model. Well, it's strange, because aren't you a model? Yeah, but what are you a model for? Oh, you're a model for a model. Pretend you're a model. I think that's fucking hilarious. You have no idea what I'm talking about? That's the kind of thing that makes me giddy and made today a good day. Really, the fact that I just thought that makes today a good day. I'm not kidding. I feel very good. Today's done for me. Right? When I was younger, I used to have many of these thoughts in the course of a day. Now that I'm old and dying, I have about one a day, and I like that one, and I'm done. What about her? What's her deal? What's the obvious thing about her? Right. That's Denise's point out. Yeah, she's closed. What is the really obvious thing? What? Her eyes are closed. She's a painter with her eyes closed. Right? There's such a weird shifting of gazes here. Right? So what kind of painter paints blinds? I mean, it's such a complicated play of the real, of the inscription, of who's looking at whom. We're looking at her looking blindly at nothing while he's looking at us, and he's looking at us, looking at him, looking at his own dick, looking at her, looking at nothing. There's just such a complicated, you could map this thing and it would never end, the sort of play of gazes. All right, let's stop looking at this painting. Oh. Now Warhol, man, Warhol is a genius. Genius, of great philosopher of identity. Right? Look how different this is than the Freud. What argument is being made here? Oh, good. Excellent. Say more. Excellent. It's nothing but interpretations, right? All the way back to the real. So the point being what? That Marilyn will herself always already have been in another permutation, another exercise in style, right? These aren't pictures of Marilyn, right? One of these might be the so-called real Marilyn, but what difference would it make, right? Marilyn is always already something that's being worked over, inflected, yeah.
The manner in which the makeup really gets highlighted in the images, I think just sort of reinforces that breakdown of real and...
Yeah, say more.
Well, the face is already painted. So,
good.
If
yes, I see what you're saying.
Real behind there somewhere.
I see what you're saying.
That face is already painted.
Very good, exactly, right. So makeup is, you paint your face, but this is a painting, and he paints the paint as makeup, but she's already made up. I mean, that's a great word, made up. Put on your makeup. She's made up. Oh, that's such a great phrase. Are you all made up for tonight? Think about how great a phrase that is. Right? Yeah, that's the whole point. She's made up. And this is Warhol Stone. And it's the factory, man. It's just keep churning them out. Right? Identity is a silkscreen. You just add the color on top. Just endless repetition, right? Just like Quinault, without the real. This making an argument about the nature of the real, the nature of identity. It's not just a bunch of pretty Marilyns. This is a bold, aggressive argument about who we are, what it is to be. Yeah.
The repetition of some backgrounds, but the general sequence of backgrounds, says to me that she can be different varying contexts, but she can also be different within the same context.
Good, very nice, very nice. Yeah, there's an internal permutation. And external, right? It's constantly inflected both internally and externally. Somebody last semester had a good call, too, that she's also kind of made up like a transvestite. Right? So there's actually a complicated play on gender. Right? I mean, I have a good friend who one tranny shack. Do you know Tranny Shack in the City? It's like a transvestite show where people perform and you get awards, and you have no idea what I'm talking about. But she won. She's a woman who played a woman. She was a woman in drag, a woman being a woman in drag. And she won the tranny show. Right? Think how complicated that is. Right? It's brilliant. It's brilliant. She actually performs around. She's really smart, but it's... Right, Marilyn as a transvestite is very complicated. Think about that a little bit. Or not, as the case may be. All right, anyone else want to talk about these Warhols? Have you seen this before? Right, these are sort of common image, right? It's almost an effect now you can put in Photoshop, Warhol it. But you understand what you're doing now when you do that. You're like, you're making an argument, a casual argument, about the endless deferral of identity, the endless proliferation of identity, that identity doesn't come back to a fixed thing, but is another permutation of a permutation of a permutation all the way down. Your turtle's all the way down. That's what happens when you hit that little effect. Right? When you go to like Sears and they take your family portrait, you're like, oh, do you want it Warhol'd? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great. I don't know. It's always on these things. Again, I have a bunch of DVDs lying around for various semesters. I've taught these. So now we're looking at Dubuffet. What's going on here? What? Just tell me one thing that's going on here.
I see a bull, but in the same time I see a tree. On the hill.
You're right. You want to say, but okay, that's good. So what's going on here is. There's somehow a picture of something. That's one of the things going on. What else? What's going on in the painting? What is this painting performing?
Abstract naked lady.
Okay, but again, you guys are both speaking to the object that it's a picture of, but speak to the performance of the painting.
Almost sophisticated images.
Okay, good. How? Okay. What do you mean?
Well, if you kind of ignore the top half of it, it kind of looks like some kind of animal, but it's kind of like there's a head sticking out. You've got to kind of think of the body. So
right. What if there's a... Right. Right. What if there's a point at which it doesn't make a difference what it is? Right? We're no longer talking about a picture of. Just as a text, I've told you over and over again, doesn't describe the world, that is the world happening. The text isn't of itself an event. Right? When you read Nietzsche, he's not talking about the world. That is the world happening as you read the text. The same here. This isn't a picture of something. This is an event. This is a performance. What is it performing? Right? It's not just that it's, oh, that's a funny picture of a person, animal thing. Well, sure, but it's also the fact that objecthood is elusive. Elena.
So then perhaps the argument is that man is animal and animal.
No, I'm not collecting these yet. What's going on here? Yeah. Okay, good. Sure, good. Absolutely. And keep pushing it. What's one thing that's kind of obvious here? About the texture, the palette of this, the patina. What's going on? How about foreground, background? Kind of oddly continuous, yeah? It's totally flat. And the sort of texture of the canvas and the texture of the body are one and the same thing. Right? So it's almost, again, we saw this a little bit in Freud. Freud was almost a little more complicated because of the floor and the leaves coming over those four freaks on the couch on that little bench, they all begin to bleed, right? Foreground and background begin flowing through each other. So rather than people occupying a space on the world there, and then I'm here and the world's back there, here they share a common plane, right? The very fabric of the world is the fabric of me. The fabric of this, if this is a person or an animal or an object, it has the same texture as the thing it's on. Which is a little strange, right? Does that make sense? So like if you're on the ocean and then the ocean's continuous with you and you're just the shape of the ocean. You're a shape of matter that's flowing everywhere, right? Rather than being a different thing than the background. Yeah.
Everything that the person views, or that whatever it is viewing, and it takes everything and puts it inside, and then reflects back out.
What's this inside? Where does this inside thing happen?
Well, inside the body, the whole life. You know, you see that kind of animal, you see the whole, you see a tree, you see everything. It could have been all on, you know, behind that individual, because you see the head on top. But
right.
It takes everything and just kind of puts it from the inside to do that. For us, if you everything that he would normally see just from the inside of the body.
Okay. Not quite sure I see what you're saying, but yeah, I mean, there is a flattening of perspective, right? And this cohabitation. Right? You're saying this inside out. I'm saying let's just get rid of that whole move from inside to out and just say it all happens on one plane. Does that make sense? Which is kind of the argument I'm making all on this class, right? That there's no behind the text, right? The world is flat. Well, that's not true. The world is surface. It's not necessarily flat, right? The surface can be very complicated, right? Does that make sense? Right. What's the obvious example? Someone, do you have a piece of paper? You have a piece of paper from a pad? No. Oh, you got writing on there. Right. So the world can be flat, but just because it's surface doesn't mean it's flat, right? So, bye, Crystal. Right. The world can be really folded up and convoluted, but still be all surface. Right. So I think you get that a little bit here. It's all surface, but doesn't mean it's not inflected. Doesn't mean it's flat. Does that make sense? A Mobius strip is another example of something that's all surface, but is twisted and pleated. Yeah, Lena. It's generous, yeah. Good. Yeah. I mean, I like that. I like, right, I mean, this, the difference between what's here and what's here doesn't seem to be that different, right? So, I mean, inside and outside is begins to break down a little bit. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like primitive art. Yeah. Right. This is de Buffet, and he's, we'll look at a couple more. Oops, wrong one. I don't want to look at that. Oh, yeah. Oh, I love that. Oh, yeah. What do we learn here? Come on. There you go. Oh, yeah. What's going on here? That's the only cow I ever want. If I'm ever like a start like a cow farm, a beef or dairy farm, this is what I'm getting. No, I want a whole herd of these. I'm serious, right? I mean, that's the best cow I've ever seen. Let me ask you this: is this a picture of a cow? Or is it a cow? I mean, what I kind of love is not, I'm not asking you if it's a cow or not a cow. I'm asking if it's a picture of a cow. What I want to argue is that this is not a picture of a cow. This is a cow. This is, right? Just as we talked about the rhizome, right? The rhizome of words and things. This is cow too. What would actually be the cow? I could have a cow in the room, but is that cow? That's one way of going cow. Sometimes my little boy runs down the hall and he goes, moo. That's cow. Right? This is cow. There's all kinds of ways of going cow. And what I love about De Buffet is he looked at cow and he's like, did you know cow could do this also? Right? When you go to a motel and there's a picture of cows lowing in the fields, right? They're seeking to confirm something you already know and think. That's what cows are. Cows are these innocuous sort of heavy beasts that kind of confirm some image of the pastoral, safe, clean, pastoral image, right? De Buffet looks at cows, he sees something else. Remember, when you look at an object, you're not just seeing, you see this object, you see the object in it, but you also see the seeing of it. When you look at this, you're seeing De Buffet seeing a cow. This is how he sees cows. He's telling you that this is one thing cows can do. Cows can do this too. Right? I didn't know that. I never thought about cows like this. He changed the way I think about cows. Like if I were a bovinologist, right, and I were in school and I was studying bovines, right, and I was studying cows, I would look at a Dubuffet and go, huh, that's an interesting theory of the cow. You've given me a new understanding of the cow. I didn't know cows could be so sort of playful, so sort of at one with the, with, I don't know, with their background, how they can sort of kind of be all googly-eyed and sort of, I don't know, this is how, and sort of lumpy, I don't know, this is a mode of cow going, a mode of being cow that I don't think you'll necessarily find in a book on cows. And my guess, most of us wouldn't find it on a farm. But when Dubuffet goes to a farm, this is the cow he sees. And sometimes he sees, come on, right, that ruins my flow there. Just be more dramatic. There we go. Sometimes he sees that guy, which is different, right? And you could see that if he kept making more and more cows, he would give you a whole cowology. He'd give you a whole way of how cows can go. It's not just a picture of a cow anymore. If you got a picture of a cow, why would you ever want to look at a picture of a cow? Don't give me a picture of a cow. Give me cow. Give me how you see cow. Give me your spin. Give me your argument about cowdom. Right? And you could see, you could take all the pictures of cows ever, and you would see all these different arguments about what cows are, how cows go, what cows can do, how they can live in this world. I'm not kidding, right? Oh, yeah. Very different than the Freud and the Warhols. All these are giving you different arguments. A, they're giving you different arguments about what art is. We're not talking about that here because it's not really in our purview. But they're also giving you arguments about what it is to see people and what people are. Right? Every painting, every image gives you a whole complex, a whole network of arguments about how to see, about what seeing is, about how to represent or create seeing, and it makes an argument about the so-called thing itself. So this is a very strange argument about personhood. Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right, let's see if we get a better one. Oh, yeah. So this is a, if anyone cares, this is a contemporary painter, Matthew Ritchie. What's going on here? Right, fair enough. Right, so this is obviously this is a photograph of a painting in a gallery or museum. What does Matthew Ritchie teach us about the world? How does the world go, according to Matthew Ritchie, in this painting? Good. Okay. Yeah, it's clearly not. It's not. It's very rarely has 90-degree angles. It's not rigid to a box. Right? It wants to bleed, wants to flow, wants to move, wants to extend itself. That's good, right? Yeah, so.
It's kind of like playing with science versus art a little bit, because it's in this white room that really resembles a lab.
Good.
And it's kind of like joking, like, fine, if I put it in, you know, this clean laboratory and I give you this picture, then will you accept the science? Well, here, I'll give you this wacko jazz.
Yeah, absolutely. And the gallery has that kind of weird white cube thing, right? It's called the white cube, right? And always trying to break it. A lot of modern art is always trying to break that white cube rather than just art on the wall. They're trying to break out of the cube. Things like performance art, right? Installation art, right? But Matthew Ritchie does it another way, right? But there's that weird relationship between the gallery space and the lab space, right? This thing that will just be neutral, that will allow us to present the world. It's a good point at which the lab is a kind of gallery space. I told you, I love labs. I love being in labs. I love looking at labs. It's filled with so many weird, beautiful things. Right? All the weird little gas faucet things and outlets. And I love the beakers. Beakers are so gorgeous. Aren't they? I mean, you get these weird shapes of glass. In my own house, I only have so many shapes of glass. A surprising number of shapes of glass, to be perfectly honest. But it's because each booze needs its own glass, which is important, right? Like the martini glass. You know about the martini glass? You drink martinis in a martini glass? What's cool about a martini glass is that it's hard to drink a martini. So you get the strongest drink, right? Because what's a martini? It's just basically straight gin, watered down a little bit, right? So you're basically drinking a couple shots of gin, maybe a hint of vermouth. Maybe you have an olive in there. So you're drinking something very strong. It's cold, so you're supposed to drink it quickly. But it's also very hard to hold. And obviously, the drunker you would get, the more martinis you have, the harder it would be to hold, right? Which is why the martini glass is cool, right? Because that's what the cool is. The cool is to be lit up and not show it. That's the definition of the cool, right? It's to have all this kind of gumption and passion, but not be slopping, right? To get drunk and fall down ain't cool. So the martini glass performs the cool. That's why you have to drink a martini in a martini glass. That's what it is. It says, are you cool? And can you perform cool? Not, it's not the cool to hold the glass. It's cool to be able to handle the glass. It's not a symbol. It performs the cooldom. Right? So labs, like galleries, are these kinds of white spaces with all this beautiful stuff. So that's good, Priscilla, right? Now, what else happens here? I mean, think how it breaks down the cube. It traverses the line. It doesn't care about these rigid lines. It operates with a fundamentally different shape of the world. You know anything about string theory? Right? Yeah, string theory, right? So imagine, right, they argue, right, is a string a loop? Is it folded over? Is it just a straight wiggly line? Right? As scientists, contemporary physicists try to argue that, you know, the basic unit of matter is string, this little vibrating stuff, right? And it vibrates at different intensities, and they all argue, is it round? Or is it like a pubic hair? Is it straight? What is its shape? And they argue about this. Right? But very rarely is the string at a 90-degree angle. Right? But hierarchies, like outlines, or, you know, zoology classifications, always at a 90-degree angle, right? Things don't bleed across categories, right? Everything's in a rigid grid. Does that make sense? How knowledge functions like a grid, right? Everything goes into its proper category. Look how Matthew Ritchie sees the world. Doesn't really function in a grid, right? I'd argue, and Matthew Ritchie makes up, constantly produces cosmologies. He's a cosmologist. Right? He's aware of what's going on here, right? And he creates cosmologies. I would argue that this is the world going. The world flows. The world is filled with collision. Right? That's both violent and not violent. That's productive. Right? That there are things with different speeds and intensities. Certain things move a little slower. Certain things go really fast. But fundamentally, the world is a place of speed. I mean, these seem pretty fast to me. This isn't slow art. You look at the Lucian and Freud, the skin seems to ooze, right? Viscous, slow, oil. You look at Matthew Ritchie, things are zinging, man. Things are moving, but with a lot of variable speeds. This is his image of the world. This is a cosmology. Look at that. I'm a big fan of Matthew Ritchie's. Right? This is how I see the world. This is what I see happening in the world. This is like, yeah, I look at that, I'm like, yep, that's pretty much what I'm trying to teach you. This is the argument I'm trying to make. There's a lot of stuff happening. It's all over the place. It kind of coheres. It kind of doesn't. It doesn't have to unify into one thing. It can be differentiated. This can be going on down here. This can be going on up here. This is a text. This is, to me, is the perfect image of a text. Does that make sense? Right? If you think about all the things that are happening when you read a text, the ethos, pathos, logos, the conceptual plays, the way Nietzsche wraps it back around himself. Right? This is, to me, a good text looks like this. Right? The texts I generally like have a certain complexity and a certain internal variability. Certain parts go faster, slower. They have different levels of complexity that interact with each other at different speeds. That's Matthew Ritchie. That's how he sees the world. When you look at an image, you're looking at a seeing of the world. You're being given an argument about how the world goes. This is an argument about how the world goes. Just as Nietzsche gives you an argument about how the world goes, Roland Barthes gives you an argument about how the world goes, this classroom makes an argument about how the world goes. Right? The fact that you have to sit here, you guys want to get out of here so bad, I'm not going to let you go. Right? For another 10 minutes, that's an argument about how the world goes. Right? In this world, I have some authority, and I'm flexing it, right? Because I think, if nothing else, you should see some fucking art before you die. And so this is it, okay? This is look at some things before you go. Right? This is an argument about how things go. Yeah.
I don't know if this works necessarily, but like today I'm not wearing my contact and I'm looking at it and the yellow and the white, yeah, I know this is, but the yellow and the white, they almost look tactile to me as if I could touch it.
Yeah.
I don't know, it makes me think of perspective of like glasses and how it kind of narrows in.
Sure,
you and
sure. Absolutely. And you can't tell, is it on the walls, on the floors, is it floating? You don't know what the hell's going on here. But it kind of eludes space. It's multidimensional. Right? He operates, I think Matthew Ritchie operates in many more, much more like string theory, right? In 7, 9, 11 dimensions. Four dimensions don't apply here, right? Right? All good art is four-dimensional. Is that obvious to everybody? Right? It's obviously has a height, a weight, a depth, and a length, a width, a depth, and a temporality. If it doesn't have temporality, it's not art. Nothing was created. It's death. It doesn't happen, right? If it's happening, if it's art that does something, then it's four-dimensional, right? Motel art doesn't want to challenge you very much, nor maybe should it. You're in a motel. It's got to deal with hundreds of people, thousands of people, day after day, who want to feel like they're home. They don't want to rip you out of your home, you know, and imagine going, checking into a hotel, and there's that Luch and Freud portrait over your bed. I mean, Jesus, you wouldn't sleep a wink, right? Or this thing, you're like, honey, let's go to a different hotel, right? That's why hotel art is so innocuous. It's not really art. It's wallpaper, right? And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's just not art. It wants to make you feel at home, right? That's its goal. So it's not about taking you out of your home. It's about bringing you home. It's about, you know, the domestication of you, the bourgeoisification of you. Now you're just home. Everything's nice. Right. I like the idea when you walk through a museum, you get all these different competing, conflicting, cohering, indifferent arguments about what the world is. It's so great. You know, you look over and you look at a Picasso, you're like, oh, that's such a funny way to see the world. Whenever I look at Miro paintings, which I wish I had here. I know you can picture Miro. I laugh my ass off. I'm like, what a good way to see the world. I like that. I want to learn to see the world like that. He's teaching me to see the world that way. To see the world that way. To literally see it. Right? When I look at the Bacon and the Freuds, I'm like, okay, that is a way to see the world, but I don't think I want to see it that way. I like that's a possibility. You know, you see the Francis Bacon's flesh falling off these mauled bodies in pain and agony. I'm like, you know, I get it. That is one way to see the world. Not for me. Oh, look at that. Look at that. Look at all those variable intensities. Look at when it takes on a certain heat. Look at the play of temperature across here. What if you read the world as nothing but an endless play of temperatures? Right? In a way it is. That's what weather is. That's what the movements of the world. The whole movement of the earth is literally premised on us shifting temperatures. Without shifting temperature, nothing happens. Right? These kinds of shifts to hot and cold make wind, make movement. That's what movement is. That's what life is shifting temperatures. Look at all these shifting temperatures. Right? When things flare up, die down, dissipate. Right? The kind of coldness of this, the burning heat in here, and that might be a banal reduction, but you begin to see that there's these variable intensities that won't stay within their grid, that want to sprawl. And I would argue that these are really images, not just of how the world goes, but how the world creates itself. These are ontogenetic. This is the world coming into being. And as you make it as an artist, you can tell that he's made it at this point, because you're allowed to make really big things. Right? You're allowed to take over the gallery and draw on the walls and make digital things. And so he's sort of contemporary canon. Look at that. Right, but look how he redistributes the gallery space, redistributes the cube. It's not just the thing on the wall. The thing that comes off the wall, comes around you, moves around you. Literally re-navigating, recreating the space that you're in. And it becomes an architect. It becomes an architect of experience, which of course all art does. I told you when you looked at the Freud, where are you standing when you're looking at it? You're literally off your feet. Here's Matthew Ritchie doing a similar thing. Where are you in relationship to the work? It literally repositions you. Huh? Is that me? No. Oh, yeah, the bald head there? No, that's not me. All right. So, quickly, right before you go and hand these things in, You have an assignment over break. It is on the blog. But over break, you need to read the Marshall McLuhan, Medium is the Massage. And you need to write, type up, and hand in a summary. I don't want more than a paragraph. I personally am collecting them, okay? So on the Tuesday after break, you will write a summary and hand in to me of Marshall McLuhan's The Medium is the Massage. All right, for Vince, hold on. For Vincent's papers, hand them to Vincent. If you are handing them to John, give them to me up here, right here on the table.